Good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you of the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, and please don't call unless you're specifically asked to, because we have our special guest this evening. It's Michael Trudeau from Colonial Resources. We're going to be talking about what's happening to the economy. Now, if you look at things, they really don't look too bad. A month or so ago, the government announced that they'd created something like 220,000 new jobs. Somewhere between 200,000 and 220,000. The statistics really sounded pretty great until you looked and saw what the jobs were. 17% of them were government jobs, and all the rest were in service jobs of one sort or another. Not one of them was a manufacturing job. And you can't have a great country or a great economy if you're not having manufacturing jobs. And the truth of the matter is, there is an organized plan to transfer the manufacturing base of this country offshore, to outsource not only, you know, some of our very high-paying jobs, but some of even moderate-paying jobs, people in answering services, architectural work, All of this is being done in China. It's being done in Korea. It's being done in India today. And they have their architects coming over here and simply picking up the jobs and taking them overseas. I have a friend of mine who builds buildings, major construction, and he commented he's building 6 or 7 major buildings now. And not one of them is, well, one of them is for manufacturing, where they have a very limited slot in manufacturing. But ordinarily, all the jobs, all the buildings, most of the buildings should be manufacturing. We just are not building plants for manufacturing because we're not doing it here and we're not going to do it in the future. And with the skyrocketing prices of oil, where will it stop? Well, we're going to talk about all of those things tonight with our special guest, Michael Trudeau, as we analyze what's happening to America and what people must do if they're going to survive in the very difficult times that lie ahead. Michael, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Always a pleasure to join you and the listeners, Stan, no question about it. You brought up an interesting point talking about the manufacturing jobs being launched overseas, and I agree that that's certainly the case, and there's no argument to it. Also, though, I see the service sector jobs heading overseas at an alarming rate as well. And one of the things that I see personally that notes that to me is when I'm calling maybe, you know, down to a bank or a larger corporation, I need to get involved with customer service, and the next thing I know, I'm speaking with somebody in India, even though, generally speaking, the corporation I would assume I'm doing business with might be located in Texas. And so it's interesting that I find myself now speaking with somebody who is giving me customer service in India. So again, even the, not just manufacturing, but the service sector jobs are leaving at an alarming rate as well. It's pretty frightening to watch it happen. There's no question about it.
And I don't think that most people are aware of what's really going on. They find it difficult to believe that this is really the official policy of the United States, is to outsource our jobs, to outsource our manufacturing, and really to begin gradually to lower the living standards of the average American. And certainly as the price of oil continues going up, this is going to have a profound impact on everything in our society, isn't it?
Well, it's going to be a very large impact, and I'll tell you, I'm getting a lot of people who are asking me now as the oil, you know, you're hearing about it on the mainstream, of course, press, that oil is hitting record after record after record for a barrel as far as the price goes. So I'm getting a lot of people who are asking me my opinion as to what I think it is.
All right, hold that thought right there. Hold that thought right there, Michael. We're going to have to take a little brief interlude, and we'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, I guess this evening is Michael Trudeau. Pick up the story. You were just saying that you're getting a lot of calls from people who really are concerned about the rising price of oil.
Right, and I mean, rightfully so. It's interesting. I buy myself, you know, I guess I commute about an hour and a half each direction from my home in Wisconsin to my office just outside of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And so, you know, certainly I notice an impact on the gasoline price right away because of that commute. And I notice, for instance, as it's creeping up past the $2 range, then it's into the 230s. Well, then this acceleration begins, and now it's the 250s. Then I think the national average right now jumped from 250 yesterday to about probably 255, 259. I know I paid $2.65 a gallon this morning. And it's interesting because, you know, today we had oil close to $67 a barrel, I think is where it was yesterday, 1 year ago today, roughly about $44. And the national average for a gallon of gasoline was about $1.89. So it is on a lot of people's minds, and you're hearing about it in the mainstream pretty well continuously. And I'm getting a lot of people that are asking, you know, again, what my opinion is of this. Well, I did some research many years back, now I guess when I first began this quest into peak oil. And again, the reason I did it was just because it was on the horizon. I thought, you know, this is something that should merit further investigation at bare minimum. And so I did a little bit of research on it. Now, obviously, with this acceleration, I've done quite a bit more. But peak oil, which is also known as Hubert's Peak or Hubert's Phenomenon, is named for the Shell geologist Dr. Marion King Hubert. In 1956, Hubert accurately predicted that the United States' domestic oil production would peak somewhere around 1970. He also predicted that global production would peak around 1995, which it would have had the politically created oil shocks in the 1970s not delayed the peak for about a decade, and thus it's hitting now instead of roughly a decade ago. And you know, there's a lot of speculation as to whether it's real or perceived, this peak oil issue, and we can touch on the aspect of peak oil a little bit deeper here in a minute. But I want to touch on the whether or not I really believe in this or not. And I would say that after the research that I've done, I personally am going to opine that I would tend to believe is that it is probably accurate. And the reason I say it is that it's both civilian scientists as well as government scientists and politicians who are coming to the same conclusions at the same time. So again, it's people that would have no political aspirations or no connections to, you know, the central banking cartel or the Bush administration or anything, and these are just civilian scientists who are saying yes and geologists who are saying yes, this is accurate. This is basically a plethora who's who of widely respected geologists, physicists, investment bankers across the world, and basically they're rational, professional, some conservative individuals who are absolutely terrified by this phenomenon known as global peak oil.
Michael, I'm going to ask you to hang on to that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Michael Trudeau, and he's exploring this concept of peak oil. In other words, are we beginning to decline in the amount of oil that's available for us and for the world, especially now that the Chinese are really beginning to explode as far as the utilization of oil is concerned? I mean, it was Napoleon who many years ago said, you know, let China slumber, for when China awakens, the world will tremble. Well, China has been brought into the 20th century, now the 21st century, by actions of our government, and China is becoming the second greatest importer of oil right now, and it won't be long before she'll be the greatest importer of oil as her economy improves and the 1.3 billion people who live there want to have cars, want to raise their living standards. And today, China is the second largest importer of oil in the world and is competing with the United States throughout the world, competing for the oil from Venezuela, which we're dependent upon. They've recently bought up the oil shale in Alberta. And, of course, there's a tremendous amount of oil in the oil shale and oil sands of Canada. But the Chinese now have purchased that using, of course, American dollars that we've so graciously extended to them because we've lowered our tariffs and made it very easy for them to sell our goods in our country and certainly undercut our industry. And now with those dollars, they're buying up the oil of Canada, which we could have utilized. They're building pipelines from Alberta out to the coast. So the oil that would have been available to the United States in past now will be shipped over to China. There's boundless amounts of oil there. It's very expensive to get out, but the Chinese are planning on getting that for their market. But, of course, it won't be available to the American market. So pick up the story there, Michael.
You bring up a good point with Venezuela as well, because Hugo Chavez has basically made the statement recently that it doesn't matter what goes down next because they can't produce more oil. They can't get it out of the ground and find it faster than they are now. And it wouldn't help us too much anyway because, as you pointed out, China's outbidding us for the Venezuelan oil anyway, and they are the number four exporter of oil. Head of oil exporting nations has made the same statement as has the head of OPEC, which is to say we cannot produce any oil faster than we are now, and at the rate of current consumption, we're in trouble. And it's interesting that when we point out that consumption aspect, is Vice President Dick Cheney himself in a 1999 speech that he gave while still CEO of Halliburton, he said by some estimates there will be an average of 2% annual growth in global oil demand over the years ahead, along with conservatively a 3% natural decline in production from existing reserves, and we're seeing that now. That means, he goes on to say, that by 2010, we will need on the order of an additional 50 million barrels a day, and that is no small sum of oil. And the aspect that I think is the most interesting to me, or I guess probably more than that, the most alarming to me, is the average person that I'm talking to about this is saying, yeah, this is really bad because the gas is this, and I just filled my tank and it cost me that. And again, I'll grant you, it's certainly something that I noticed right away because of my commute, and definitely I can see the amount of dollars it takes to fill my tank going up every single time I'm doing it. But again, where we're talking about is not about the gasoline prices. We are talking about something so much more severe because petrochemicals are key components to much more than just the gas in your car. As geologist Dale Allen Pfeiffer points out in his article entitled Eating Fossil Fuels, approximately 10 calories of fossil fuels are required to produce every single calorie of food eaten in the United States. The size of this ratio stems from the fact that every step of modern food production, of course, is fossil fuel and petrochemical power. And you start to think about this. Pesticides are made from oil. Commercial fertilizers are made from ammonia, which is made from natural gas, which will be peaking about 10 years after oil peaks. With the exception of roughly a few experimental prototypes here, all farming implements such as tractors, trailers, combines, everything, it's all constructed and powered using petroleum. Food storage systems like refrigerators are manufactured in oil-powered plants, distributed across oil-powered transportation networks, and usually run on electricity, which most often comes from natural gas or coal. When you start to factor in that in the United States, the average piece of food is transported about 1,500 miles before it gets to your plate, and in Canada, the average piece of food is transported 5,000 miles from where it was produced to where it's consumed, you start to get a larger picture of how much this is going to impact us. It's not just transportation and agriculture that are entirely dependent on abundant, cheap oil, though, because now you can bring in modern medicine, water distribution, national defense, all are entirely powered by oil and petroleum-derived chemicals. So regardless of this peak oil aspect and how severe this might be, any aspect of what's happening here, as far as whether this is real or perceived as this oil price gets ratcheted up, you can begin to realize that this is going to have a massive impact in the negative on the economy.
Well, I think the important thing is, Michael, that our listeners must understand what it is going to drive up the price of everything. And as the prices go up and people have to put more and more money into buying the bare essentials, they're not going to have money to invest in all the things that they have in the past. They're not going to have the money for the comfortable vacations. They're not going to have the money for the luxury items that they've been buying. They're even going to have difficulty and increasing difficulty making the payment, the large payment on the new house that they bought with the inflated prices. So this can begin to drive the whole economy down. In other words, it can begin to slow down the whole pace of our economy. And this is a thing that I think everybody should be aware of. And I don't think that $67 a barrel for oil is the top. I think we're going to see a lot higher than that. Because I really believe that there are people who would like to get us out of our cars, who want us to conserve. In fact, there's an organized, orchestrated effort, if you watch the media. Conserve, conserve. Conserve electricity, conserve oil. Don't turn on your air conditioner too high. Don't turn your heat up too high. Put on a sweater. Use a fan in your house when it gets oppressively hot. There's a coordinated plan all across America, and not only to get us to conserve, but now I can see increasingly to force us to conserve. And the rising and skyrocketing price of oil, which I think has just begun, I would think will play an important part in changing the Americans' perception of how we travel, how we live, and we'll see a gradually lowering of our living standards.
Well, you're right on target when you say the, you know, gradual lowering of our living standards. And I think that's something that we'll just see, period, no matter what's coming next. But I'm concerned about the fact that this may be something that gets so rapidly dropped upon us that it's not just a matter of something that we gradually see deteriorate in our way of living, but I think it's something where we could be reduced to third world status fairly quickly. And that's the aspect that makes me very concerned, because as this oil price continues to rise, it literally will topple full-blown economies, and it will do so very quickly. Basically, one of the things that you look at when we talk about oil in the respect of what it really represents is it basically kind of represents money in one fashion. The aspect of the global financial system here, this is kind of one of the major problems, is that the financial system is basically entirely dependent on a constantly increasing supply of oil, and that's the key, that it's got to be continually increasing. All modern economic activity, from transportation to food production, as I pointed out, to manufacturing, is dependent on oil supplies. Money is really just a symbol for that oil. And when we start to talk about, you know, where the price of this might go, it begins to boggle the mind as to what some of the people are predicting. Some of the people in the know, too, I mean, not just, you know, the average Joe, one of George Bush's energy advisors, and I got to stop and say, I don't put a whole bunch of stock into, you know, any administration's advisors one way or the other, unless I can see some information outside of the administration that points to the individual himself as having some good credentials. And one of his advisors is an energy investment banker by the name of Matthew Simmons. He's spoken at length about this impending crisis. And we should point out that Simmons himself basically is strongly nonpartisan on energy issues. His writings are highly regarded amongst the energy and banking community for their grounding in nonpartisan, heavily documented, and virtually infallible research and analysis. Simmons Investment Bank, Simmons and Company International, is considered the most reputable and reliable energy investment bank in the world. So given Simmons' background, what he has to say about the situation is truly terrifying. In an August 2003 interview with From the Wilderness publisher Michael Rupert, Simmons was asked, if it was time for peak oil to become part of the public policy debate. And he responded, it's past time. As I've said, the experts and politicians have no plan B to fall back on. If energy peaks, particularly while 5 billion of the 6.5 billion people have little or no use of modern energy, it will be a tremendous jolt to our economy, as well as our well-being and to our health, greater than anyone could have ever imagined. When asked if there was a solution to the impending natural gas crisis, Simmons responded, I don't think there is one. The solution is to pray. Under the best of circumstances, if all prayers are answered, there will be no crisis for maybe 2 years. After that, though, it's an absolute certainty. In May 2004, Simmons explained that in order for demand to be appropriately controlled, the price of oil would have to reach $182 a barrel, and gas prices would likely hit about $7 a gallon. His predictions are downright tame, though, compared to what other analysts in the world of investment banking are preparing themselves for. For instance, in April 2005, just this year, French investment bank Ixis CIB warned crude oil prices would touch $380 a barrel by 2015. Want to ponder just how devastating oil prices in the $200 to $400 a barrel range will be for the United States economy? Oil prices that far north of $100 a barrel would almost certainly trigger massive last-ditch global resource wars as the industrialized nations of the world scramble to grab what little of the black stuff is remaining. And it's interesting because you start to see this scenario portraying itself as we move into Iraq and now the rattling of the sabers with Iran. This might explain why the director of the Selective Service recently recommended the military draft be expanded to include both genders, ages 18 to 35. A March 2005 report prepared for the United States Department of Energy confirmed dire warnings the investment banking community entitled The Mitigation of the Peaking of World Oil Production. The report observed without timely mitigation, world supply-demand balance will be achieved through massive demand destruction or shortages, accompanied by huge oil price increases, both of which would create a long period of significant economic hardship worldwide.
Well, I think we're in for some very, very difficult times. There are things that can be done, but they're all going to be expensive. Just remember that for years, there's been an active, organized effort to prevent having nuclear energy in America. Telling the American people, oh, we can't have nuclear energy. What would we do with the fuel? This spent fuel? Nobody ever pointing out that every other country in the world reprocesses the fuel. And Congress had initially passed laws that had prevented us from doing it. And, you know, it's a very simple thing, actually, to have nuclear energy. We're just not allowed to have it here in America. I believe somebody wants a crisis, and I believe we're going to have one. We'll be back in just a moment with Michael Trudeau. Well, Michael, pick up the story there, because you're painting a very bleak picture, and I don't think it matters whether this is real or whether it is perceived. There is going to be a crisis, because they are going to effectively block anything really to solve the problem, which they are doing very effective. They've been doing it for a long period of time, and the perfect example would be how effectively they block the utilization of nuclear power here in the United States. Now, the United States has been, at least in the past, building a nuclear reactor for North Korea, but we can't have them in the United States. The United States recently authorized and guaranteed the loans for building 5 nuclear reactors in communist China. We're guaranteeing the loans, $5 billion, for the Chinese communists to build those reactors, even though they're holding over $700 billion of our money. But we're guaranteed that those 5 reactors, the first in 50 nuclear reactors China's going to build, but we can't have nuclear reactors in the United States. Certainly, France gets 80% of its electricity from nuclear reactors, but we can't have it here in the United States because we're not as smart as the French. They know what to do with their spent nuclear fuel rods. We don't. Something's wrong with the whole story. I believe that they have blocked effective solutions because I believe there are some people who want a crisis, and I will tell you that right now the great oil companies are just rolling in money. You know, they have more money than they know what to do with. The skyrocketing oil prices, and I agree with you, I think those prices have just begun to rise.
One of the things that you bring up, of course, is the nuclear power aspect, and you're right on target with it being, you know, one of the safer ways to go. As a matter of fact, it's probably the single cheapest and probably the most environmentally safe way to produce power. Now the problem comes down, however, to too little too late. When one of the questions that I get a lot of when it comes to this peak oil aspect is, well, what about solar power and what about wind generators and so on? Again, the now problem with that is that we didn't get on this fast enough. We would have had to have produced all of these things well in advance And, of course, we didn't have the technology yet to do so, because now the problem is it's too little too late. When we consider the role of oil in the production of modern technology, remember that most alternative systems of energy, which would include solar panels, solar nanotechnology, windmills, hydrogen fuel cells, biodiesel production facilities, nuclear power plants, what have you, they all rely on sophisticated technology. And the problem is when we look at how much oil goes into that sophisticated technology, the construction, for instance, of the average desktop computer consumes 10 times its weight in fossil fuels. And, you know, this is one of those things where you sit back and go, boy, that's a significant problem right by itself. And then we start to look at all electrical devices, which, of course, use silver, copper, gold, platinum, each of which is discovered, extracted, transported, and then fashioned using oil-powered machinery. For instance, to produce a ton of copper, it requires roughly the equivalent of 17.8 barrels of oil. The energy cost component of aluminum is about 20 times higher than that. Nuclear energy, of course, requires uranium, which is also discovered, extracted, and then transported using oil-powered machinery. Most of the feedstocks, soybeans, corn for biofuels, such as biodiesel and ethanol, are grown using, of course, high-tech oil-powered industrial methods. So again, more of the same problem. I want to touch back on that report that came out, again, talking about how severe this is on the U.S. Department of Energy. It went on to say that the problems associated with world oil production peaking will not be temporary. The challenge of oil peaking deserves immediate serious attention. The world has never faced a problem like this one. Previous energy transitions were gradual and evolutionary. This is where I made that point about seeing us get thrust into a third world situation, literally almost what would be figuratively, I guess, more than literally, but literally it would seem like it overnight.
Michael, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought, because we're going to bring all of our stations back on board right now. All right, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Michael Trudeau from Colonial Resources, and we're talking about what's happening with oil. And Michael is simply saying that the end result of skyrocketing oil prices and limiting our ready access to energy, because we're an energy-dependent society. As an industrial society, we have to have energy. We have to have oil for transportation. We have to have oil for so many things. And if suddenly the price of oil goes through the roof, as it is in the process of doing today, this could rapidly change America from a first world nation to a third world nation. And people say, that could never happen here. And yet, of course, I happen to believe that there is a master plan. I think you can find it in the Earth Charter. You can get that off the internet. That's the Earth Charter. It's written by that great American patriot, Mikhail Gorbachev, and Maurice Strong, and Stephen Rockefeller. They wrote that Earth Charter, and they talk about redistributing wealth within nations and between nations. Redistributing wealth within nations and between nations. If any of you would like a copy of the Earth Charter, you don't have access to the internet, we'll be glad to send you a copy. Or just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. I believe that what's happening was planned a long time ago. Redistribution of wealth between nations. Whose wealth are they talking about? They're talking about the wealth of the people who are listening to this program, the middle class of America. But be that as it may, whether it's real or perceived, why, we are going into, I believe, a very difficult time. So pick up the story there, Michael.
Yeah, and you're right on target when you talk about us heading into a very difficult time. There's, you know, again, and we want to point out that this is something that comes down to speculation, this peak oil issue. There's no, you know, conclusive, well, I mean, there's plenty of conclusive evidence that this is accurate information. The question comes down to, you know, do you believe that it's perceived to be a threat, and it's just disinformation that we're being fed all across all these different channels, or if it's real?
It is a very, very real threat. There's no question it is real. The question is, are there things we could do to counter the shortage of oil? Well, we're not going to do it, so it really doesn't matter if there were or there's not. The thing is, I believe that we are being moved into a very difficult time. And, of course, as you know, my belief, I believe God brings judgment upon nations that turn away from him. And is there any nation that has been as blessed as this one that has repudiated God as strongly as we are repudiating him today? So with that as the background, let's go ahead with your thoughts, Michael.
I agree with that statement 100%. And, you know, again, this is something where I think that we should have and could have done much and sat back and did nothing. I think it was Edmund Burke who made the statement that all it takes for evil to succeed is for good men to do nothing. And I think that we've had just, unfortunately, too much of that, which is good men sitting back and doing nothing. And of course, I don't refer to people like yourself, Dr. Stan, because you are a good man who has certainly done much and put plenty of your own sacrifice on the line to do this. And, you know, that's one of those things that I hope the listenership appreciates, you know, what you go through when it comes to putting a program like this out there. So I certainly want to pass my hat off to you on that one. This is something that, again, we need to tell people that they really need to start educating themselves on, because this is something that's accelerating so rapidly. It's not something where you can say, well, I want to sit down in the course of the next few years and really try to learn more about this. Because I started this process like that about 3 or 4 years ago. And, you know, it was one of those things where it was just like, wow, that could that be? And I did a little research and found some interesting reports that came out from the U.S. Geological Survey. I have a friend of mine who is a professor at Arizona State University. And I talked with him about it. He's a geology professor. And I talked to him about the aspect as to whether or not this is something that sounds feasible to him. And he said he'd read plenty of the information and said not only feasible, but he believes it full-heartedly that it's 100% accurate, and that he expects that we are hitting peak oil right now at this period right here. And again, all of the information that we're seeing coming out points to the fact that, yes, this is what's occurring, and that prices of $100 a barrel oil, which is, you know, seemingly just a year ago would have been unfathomable at $44 a barrel, now seems like it's just around the corner and will not surprise anyone. If you would have asked somebody just a year ago at $44 a barrel, do you think that we'll see $100 a barrel oil next year, everyone, I think, would have probably said, no, that would be ridiculous. Now I think most people would say, boy, I just about expect it. And at that point, at $100 a barrel, you have to expect gasoline at about $5 a gallon or higher. Again, and that is going to have a massive impact just by itself right there with the transportation system and what that will do to the price of everything.
And I think so, the other thing, Michael, that most people don't understand is that the dollar is on the general down course. We've had a recent rally of the dollar, and now the dollar appears to have been peaking out and moved down. And, of course, the dollar decreases in value, the price of oil goes up automatically. So even without going up on the world market, it'll certainly go up as far as here in the United States. And I think the fact that the dollar is in a bear market is a long-term bear trend, because we're spending more than we're making, and there's no instance in all history where a nation has spent 6% more than it's exporting that nation has been able to survive indefinitely. So as the dollar begins to decline, the price of oil is going to go up in addition. So we're going to have a double whammy, and I really fear for what lies ahead. But the unsuspecting American people really have little idea what's really going on. Well, our guest this evening is Michael Trudeau, and we've just been talking about peak oil. We've been talking about what's happening in the oil market, and I think people need to listen and heed what he's saying. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, again, now, when we talk about the aspect of, you know, how do we prepare for something like this, that's really the $64,000 question, because you really can't. I mean, do you store gasoline at your home so you'll be able to transport yourself to and from your office? More importantly, when that occurs, will your office be up and running? I mean, the cost of running a typical, you know, company will be exorbitant, and companies will be crashing all around the world. So, again, this is one of those things where you sit back and say, well, what do I expect to occur, and what can I maybe prepare with? Well, you know, here's the thing about that. I've always been one of those people that believes that an ounce of preparation will certainly always beat a pound of cure. And, of course, what I mean is the ounce of preservation. But in my world, it's preparations, because I've been preparing for something like this for a long time. I did a dry run with the Y2K issue, and I learned a lot of things there about storing food and making sure that I had clean, potable water available to myself, because these are the types of things that you may not have at access. You may not, for instance, have water that's moving through a city, because it takes a lot of petroleum to do that. Well, right now, of course, I'm on a well, but I have an electric pump for my well. There may not be electricity for me, so I've made plans for that, and I've got a pipe that I can lower down my well shaft to bring water back up to the surface manually if need be. But it's little things like that that you really have to be paying attention to and thinking about. I would recommend that everybody have, if they especially live in a city, a way for them to make potable clean water, a water filtration system, and make sure it's non-electric, make sure it's gravity-fed, something where you can simply pour water in the top and have clean portable water or potable water come out the bottom, like the British Birkenfeld, or maybe the Aqua Rain is a couple of different brand names that I've seen that work real well. long-term storable foods is not a bad idea. It's one of the things that I recommend to anyone who's asking, what should I do? Long-term storable foods do not have to be fancy. They don't have to be MREs. They can include things like dried beans and dried rice stored in 5-gallon plastic pails with a lid on it. I recommend that simply because it's very inexpensive, long storable food, and it's easy to prepare. You can also bear in mind that if that scenario is coming down, you want to make sure that you've got items for comfort as well as just the food staples. So make sure you think about what it is in a day that you use in your family and that you really would not want to be doing without in a shortage. And I mean, literally think about things like toilet paper. And as ridiculous as that might sound, it's something that you have to consider because the transportation system may be disrupted dramatically and you may not see inventory making it to the grocery stores or to your supermarkets or, shopping centers like your Walmarts or anything like that. So again, start thinking about that, and you might want to think
hold
about
that. Hold that thought right there, Michael. Sure. Just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Michael Trudeau of Colonial Resources, and he's simply talking about that we don't know what's going to happen, but certainly as we see the value of the dollar falling, as we see the price of oil going up, and right now everything really looks fairly good. But the question is it really that good, or is this sort of a mirage that's lulling us into a false sense of security? And Michael's point is, we really should start making preparations for the difficult times. Now, most people are not going to do that. Most people are going to simply drift along saying, this could never happen in America. And I would simply point out, if God is just, his justice will not sleep forever. And you can look at it from a political point of view. You can look at it from a financial point of view. You can look at it from a spiritual point of view. But we would be very, very foolish not to begin making some preparations. Michael, did you have something in the way of a little treatise on the peak oil situation that you wanted to make available to our listeners?
You bet. I've got a packet of information, Dr. Stan, that we've put together that talks about this situation, points out these surveys and these studies, and shows exactly where this is heading and what time frame we're looking at. Also, some of the things we can expect will be happening and what we might be able to do to prepare.
All right, what is it? You want to put out your telephone number,
sure,
your website?
We'd be happy to pass it out. Folks can call toll-free 1-800-685-4042. And operators will be available to pass that out this evening.
And what's and that again, number again, once again?
The number is 1-800-685-4042. 4042.
And of course, this program will be a rebroadcast in the morning here in a couple of weeks. So it'll be a morning program or an evening program, depending upon when you're actually hearing it. But go ahead, Michael. Why don't you pick up the story there?
Sure. And one of the things too that we want to do, Stan, is we can point this out as this is something that that actually is going to impact us again, whether it's real or perceived. But here's one of the things that's a real aspect: the United States did pass its own peak oil. Roughly a situation, about 11 million barrels a day, and that was in 1970. Since then, production has dropped steadily. In 2004, it ran just above 5 million barrels a day. Now, remember, in 1970, we were at about 11 million, and now, roughly 2004, we're at about 5 million barrels a day, just but roughly above that. We get a tad more from natural gas condensates, but yet we consume roughly about 20 million barrels a day now. And one of the things that you look at is that means that we're importing about two-thirds of our oil, and that ratio has been continually worsening. Now what's happening is we're hitting the global peak oil situation where the same thing is happening globally. We cannot consume the amount of oil that we're consuming now and continue to bring it out of the ground at that rate. And, of course, as that slows down, it won't just be that things have to hit a status quo economically. It's that we will begin to collapse backwards right away. And this is one of those things where you sit back and just go, wow, this is actually occurring. You brought up the inflation rate, and I wanted to touch on that because, again, what we hear from the government figures is that the inflation rate is a paltry 3%. It's comfortable. Everybody's happy at 3%. You should be just really having no problem with that. But when we look at that dollar decline, which you've brought into the picture, 12.5% annually. And, again, now that's a different situation because is it really a 3% inflation rate if my dollar is weakening at an annual rate of 12.5% and I'm now able to afford 12.5% less products with the same dollars from just last year? So I would argue that 3% inflation rate is really quite ridiculous when we look at those statistics.
Well, you know, Michael, I would simply point out that, I mean, anybody who looks at the government statistics and accepts them, they're not looking and seeing what's happening to the price of housing and rent across America.
Right.
They're not looking and seeing what's happening to the price of oil. They're not looking and seeing what's happening as far as the price of food in the markets, you know. And I mean, the price of food, every time I go down there with my wife, I'm always amazed at how much food is costing. And of course, you know, it's that old adage, are you going to believe what the government tells you, or are you going to believe your lying eyes? And I would suggest that the inflation rate is far higher than we're being told. Because as we begin our program with every evening, reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. And I would like to suggest that illusion is king today. It's the perception rather than the reality. The reality is we have rising costs. And far in excess of 3%, and all you need to do is realize that they juggle those figures and they take out anything that's going up. They substitute things coming in from China where the yuan is tied to the American dollar. It has been until quite recently. And they juggle those figures to give the American people the perception there's no inflation. And yet I think everybody out there in the listening audience knows that the dollar buys far less today than it did a year ago or 2 or 3 years ago. So, you know, they're simply not being forthright with us.
No question. And, of course, from my perspective of with my business being in precious metals, is I can see a dramatic increase in the amount of volume of sales in coins. And, of course, that tells me, as always has been the case, it's the traditional safe haven during economic uncertainty. You can definitely tell that the rest of the public is definitely a bit on edge right now, and you can see a lot more people moving into that protection-type positions. And, you know, again, the way you can see it, as you pointed out in the beginning of the program, Dr. Stan, is they're not moving into, high-grade collector's pieces, the rare artistic things. You're not seeing, like, volumes of discretionary income being spent on, you know, rare coins or artwork or rugs and things like that. Right now you're seeing people pull those purse strings tight, and they're moving into protection positions. They're paying off debts. They're moving into a lot of physical possession, gold coins, and that's one of those indicators that says, hey, people are definitely getting nervous about this and beginning to realize that this 3% inflation rate is a myth, and that it's more like, I say, 10 to 12%. And when you look at overall over the last 5 years, the dollar decline has been about 50%, and it's easy to see that, just as you pointed out, mirrored just about everywhere. I can look at the price of oil up about the same level. Obviously outpacing that a little bit, but I can look at the fact that the housing market in 5 years is up 50%. I can look at the fact in the last 5 years, gold is up 70%. Of course, healthcare is up. College educations are up. And it's not that these things have become rarer or more valuable, but of course it's become the weakened dollar that I'm paying for all of these things for, so it takes more of those weaker dollars to consume or collect anything, basically. So again, this is something that people see. It can't be hidden for long, not even from, you know, the people who are so busy working two jobs and 50-hour work weeks that they can't think straight about this stuff. Even they begin to see it because it's on the mainstream nightly news.
Well, I think that the tragedy is that most people do not understand that there really is, in my estimation, a program to impoverish the American people. I don't think our leaders dare tell the American people that. The reason that they're not trying to stop immigration, they could stop immigration from across the border if they wanted to. Every
you
barrier
saw that
has
with
been,
the Minutemen, you're right.
But they don't really want to, because by bringing in people from south of the border who work for less, why they force wages down in this country. And with rising prices and declining wages, and I tell you, we get this many, many times from people who had, you know, a high-paying job 6 or 8 years ago, and the company either went overseas or they simply started laying people off, cut back on expenses. And when they got a new job, it was perhaps a third of what they were making before. So there is an active program to impoverish the American people, but the average individual can't see that. All he sees is what's before him, and if they don't see the big picture, why, you can't really understand what indeed is going on in America today.
And again, to a limited degree, you can't really blame them or fault them too much, because, you know, the central banking cartel, this gang of thugs, this, you know, cartel families that have become this syndicated mafia, have done a very good job of keeping us busy. Again, you know, when I was a kid, my mom didn't have to work. She stayed at home with us kids. She raised us kids. My dad had a great job, worked at Honeywell as an engineer. And that was the way my grandparents were, and their parents. And it's just one of those things. Now, though, everybody has to work two, you know, both the mom and the dad have to work a job or two each, 50-hour weeks. You have no time to protest. You have no time to go onto the internet and research this information to find out how we're being duped and how we're being turned into slaves. So again, it gets hard for a collective protest to begin when they've got us pretty well, you know, backed into our own careers, and you can't do anything other than just make sure you can pay off every little amount of, you know, debt that you've got that most families have up to their eyeballs.
Well, let me just digress here for just a moment. There's a very important essay. It was written in 1965. It was written by Alan Greenspan, who today is the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. And this is what he wrote in 1965 about the economy. In the absence of the gold standard, there is no way to protect savings from confiscation through inflation. There is no safe store of value. If there were, the government would have to make its holding illegal, as was done in the case of gold. The financial policy of the welfare state requires that there be no way for the owners of wealth to protect themselves. This is the shabby secret of the welfare statist tirade against gold. Deficit spending is simply a scheme for the confiscation of wealth. Now, that was written by a man who's very smart, who today has the Federal Reserve Board, chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. And I checked out his story. I'd heard this week. I wanted to make sure it was accurate before I went on the radio with it. And basically, apparently several years ago, Congressman Ron Paul, who was really a champion of freedom, one of the finest congressmen we have, went up to the chairman Greenspan after he had given some testimony and said to Chairman Greenspan, certainly in view of the policies of the Federal Reserve System, which are certainly undercutting the value of gold, how do you feel about that essay you wrote back in 1965? Are you ready to disown your views? And Alan Greenspan looked at Ron Paul and said, I recently reread that article and I wouldn't change a word of it. Now, this is the man who is doing everything he can today to create an inflationary bubble to undermine the very fundamentals of economics. And Alan Greenspan said, I would not disown one word of what I said. Now, I verified this story with Ron Paul's public relations man just this past week, so I feel it is accurate. And the great tragedy that we have today is that the average individual has no realization of what's happening.
Right. Basically, you've hit the nail right on the head, and it's really alarming when we hear that phrase, which is deficit spending is the hidden scheme for the theft of your wealth. And why that's important, of course, is because it was said by Alan Greenspan, who is the head of the Federal Reserve. He is the chairman. And currently, what are we talking about? Of course, deficit spending. So now here's the man who is the head of the Federal Reserve System. We know we're involved in deficit spending, and he's made the statement that deficit spending is simply a hidden scheme for the theft of your wealth, and that gold is the only thing that stands in the way of that insidious process. Interestingly enough that it's the head of the chair of the Federal Reserve to make that statement. You probably wouldn't hear him make that statement, on national television. He might make it casually or quietly and privately to Ron Paul, but he certainly would not make that statement on national television, because again, it would be something where the average person would say, what? And at that point begin that process of, now wait a minute, what does this all mean to me? And how do I, you know, figure this all out? And again, it would probably cause a revolution in this country if literally the American population were to wake up to this scheme that he's talking about, that Alan Greenspan is talking about. If the population were to wake up collectively, we would march on Washington probably tomorrow and demand the ouster of the Federal Reserve.
And, of course, a lot of the politicians who've been going along with this. But, you know, if you study the history of monetary systems through the years, a paper money system is really wonderful. In fact, Aristotle wrote about this. He said there's absolutely nothing wrong with fiat money, meaning a paper money system, as long as you have perfect authority and godlike wisdom in kings. There's nothing wrong with fiat money as long as you have perfect authority and godlike wisdom in kings. And basically he's saying as long as you have people who will act responsibly and not inflate the money supply and not run prices up and not create an artificial prosperity, which eventually is going to come tumbling down, why the system will work for a while. Because he saw what happened in ancient Greece and saw the destruction of their economy. And nothing is new under the sun, as Solomon said in Ecclesiastes. The same thing has happened in ancient Rome, and it's happened time and time again. In the 18th century, it happened in the early a part of the century in France, and then it happened in the United States during the American Revolution, the continental dollar. It happened again in France in 1789 after the French Revolution. We've seen the same thing happen again and again. But the average American doesn't know history. It's not taught in our schools. It's not talked about on radio or television. But we are headed, I fear, Michael, into very, very difficult financial times. And I think it's so vitally important that people study history and we get the information. It is readily available. But you're going to have to do a little work to find out what's really going on. So, again, pick up the story from there. We've only got about 4 minutes before we go to our final break.
Well, one of the things that we talk about a lot with people is when we look at where should we go with this, is I start to look at what are some of the larger people out there who really don't have to work two jobs and can focus their attention to those. What are these people doing? The Warren Buffetts, the Bill Gates of the world, what are these people doing? And you're seeing that, as we've pointed out many times, that these are the people who are sitting back right now shorting the dollar in dramatic fashion. They're going long on gold. They're going long on silver. They're going long on oil. These are people who can see this catastrophe coming. And they're simply able, in that position that they're in, of money and power, to do something about it in the positive for themselves. They literally are sitting back and just basically saying, well, I can profit by this, which I think fairly, in my opinion anyway, is certainly fairly disgusting to think I can profit off of the misery of my fellow man, and I certainly would never attempt to do so myself personally. I think that in lieu of that, we should look at this and say, well, I'm not going to attempt to profit off my fellow man by being Johnny on the spot and figuring out, you know, what markets are going to do what for me. At this point, I'm thinking all bets are off, and we are headed for an absolute all-out world catastrophe, and people should be thinking about nothing short of survival under this. And, you know, this getting back to what Simmons had said, and he made this quote, I don't think there is one when we're talking about a solution to this impending crisis. He says the solution is to pray. And I think that is the perfect answer, and that is the perfect solution, because there is no other solution. There is no other answer to this. As one commentator recently observed, the reason our leaders are acting like desperados is because we have a desperate situation on our hands. If you've been wondering why the Bush administration has been spending money, cutting social programs, and starting wars like there's no tomorrow, now you have your answer. As far as they are concerned, there is no tomorrow. These folks believe fully that we are headed for this catastrophe, and probably because they've got a lot more information than we're privy to, and they've sat back, these cartel families, and gotten themselves fully prepared for this. I mean, these guys have got all the money. At this point, since 1913, as you pointed out, through Greenspan's message of deficit spending being the scheme of wealth theft, they've taken all of this money. They're sitting back ready to go with this thing. So they've depleted all of the world's oil. What do they care? They've probably got enough reserves to keep their families going for three or four generations.
Well, why don't you go ahead and get your telephone number and your website out just one more time. And, of course, you were actually going to offer them a free brochure on what's happening with oil?
Yep, I'd be happy to send out the packet on peak oil and all about that information. You can call toll-free. The number is 1-800-685-4042. And again, you can certainly call this evening. It's 1-800-685-4042. Or you can get more information and a lot of these articles that I get my research from right off our website, colonialresources.com.
That's colonialresources.com. Okay, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Michael, and we're going to open up we're going to wrap up this evening's program. But I think this is a very important issue. I think it's so important that people begin understanding that nothing as it appears to be. And Paul Volcker, and in a recent article published in the Washington Post on the 10th of April of this year, and you can get it off of Google, or we'll be glad to send you a copy, said, you know, everything seems to be placid. Everything seems to look fine. But I think we're skating on thin ice. Paul Volcker, former chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, will be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Michael was talking about Warren Buffett. Now, for our listeners out there who don't know about Warren Buffett, Warren Buffett is said to be one of the greatest investors of all time. I can remember, 35 years or so ago when I could have bought his stock for, I think it was $10 a share. It was well over 60, 80,000 last time I checked on it. But Warren Buffett is a very smart man. And Warren Buffett heads Berkshire Hathaway. And he is shorting the dollar. He has invested $20 billion shorting the dollar. Over this last year, he lost $300 million shorting the American dollar. And what is he going to do? Is he going to simply retract? No, he's going to hold his position because he thinks the dollar is going to continue going down. So I think that if you see what somebody who's as smart as Warren Buffett is doing, and if he is concerned about the future, the stability of our financial system, then I think we should be as well. Michael, you've got about 2 minutes now to wrap up what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I tell you, the last thing I want to point out is this hydrogen fuel cell business, because I've had a lot of people point that out, that that's the new wave of the future, and it's just right around the corner, and it'll fix this problem. The widely touted hydrogen economy is a particularly cruel hoax, though, because we're not going to be able to replace the United States automobile and truck fleet with vehicles run on fuel cells, for one thing. The current generation of fuel cells is largely designed to run the hydrogen obtained from natural gas, which we're also running out of. The other way to get hydrogen in the quantities wished for would be for electrolysis of water using power from hundreds of nuclear power plants. So apart from the dim prospect of our building that many nuclear power plants soon enough, and of course we point out how much oil that would take, there are also numerous severe problems with hydrogen's nature as an element that present forbidding obstacles to its use as a replacement for oil and gas, especially in storage and transport, of course, transportation being an issue with petroleum as well. So I just want to point that out, because that's one of the things that I kind of forgot to touch on, is the fuel cell issue, because we hear, you know, Bush talking about a lot of that fuel cell business. Boy, just right around the corner, everything will be running on hydrogen fuel cells. We'll be good to go. And that's absolutely ridiculous.
And, of course, remember the Hindenburg. That was the great American, the great German Zeppelin that came over here, and it was all full of hydrogen. It was a great airship until, of course, there was a little spark, and that was the end of the Hindenburg.
Yeah.
So I think that they're telling us a lot of things. They're telling us not to worry. Well, I think there's a lot to worry about, and I think that Michael's presentation this evening has been excellent, drawing your attention to the fact that we're being told one thing, but the reality is, whether this is real or perceived, it's going to have a profound impact on us, because they're not doing anything of the right things to solve the problems that face America today. And without oil, America as we know it will cease to be a great nation. So we're going to be back here in just a moment as we wrap up this evening's program. Our guest this evening has been Michael Trudeau from Colonial Resources, and we'll be right back here. Well, we're going to say goodnight to Michael. Michael certainly is, he and his partner do help Radio Liberty bring you this problem, this problem and this program. Michael, one more time, get out your telephone number and your website, please.
Sure. Folks can get information from us on the peak oil situation by calling 1-800-685-4042. And also information available at our website, colonialresources.com.
God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you, too, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, that was Michael Trudeau. And I really believe that there are some very real problems out there. And we're going to have to start preparing for ever-increasing rising oil prices. And they're telling us, oh, well, when the summer's over, the price is going to go down. I don't think the price is going to go down. I think they worked for a long time to get us to this point where they blocked the utilization of nuclear power here in the United States. It's been done very intentionally. And every other country can have nuclear power, but gee, shucks, we just don't know how to do it here. We can finance it in communist China. We can finance it in communist North Korea, but we can't have those power plants here in America. Why, they might explode or something like that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there is an organized effort to deceive the American people. My job here on Radio Liberty is to try to bring you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. We hope that if you'd like to get our latest newsletter, and that, of course, deals with wars and rumors of wars, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. A little while ago, we talked about the Earth Charter, if you'd like, a free copy of the Earth Charter. Why, you can either get it off the Internet, and you can go to Google and type it in, but if you don't have access to the Internet and would like a copy of the Earth Charter, why, call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you a free copy of the Internet, pardon me, of the Earth Charter, which is available on the Internet, but we'll send it to you, because it is the Mein Kampf for what's going on today. It deals with this concept of world government. It deals with the new spirituality. It deals with this redistribution of wealth, not only within nations, which is, of course, the basis of communism and socialism, and that's why Mikhail Gorbachev calls the Earth Charter the new Ten Commandments for the world. But it also deals with redistribution of wealth between nations. And what we're really talking about is the destruction of the economy of the United States and lowering our living standards to that of the third world peasants. And people say it could never happen here. And I would simply ask, if God is just, why couldn't it happen here? And so we do hope many of you will go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. We have a great talk we gave on the coming financial crisis. And of course, we have all sorts of material that is available that will help you better to understand where we're going. We have a pamphlet we put together entitled The History of Money. The History of Money is a very, very simple story. But, of course, most people don't know it because it's not taught in our schools. It's certainly not discussed well on our television or our radio or our news magazines. And you have to understand that there really is nothing new under the sun. What is happening in America today has happened time and again back through the ages. And it has always happened whenever a nation has turned its back on God and turned to hedonism, and of course flaunted the freedoms that the people had enjoyed. Well, there's never been a country that has had as much freedom as we have had, and what have we done with it? Why, just turn on your television, listen to the crude jokes, look at the scantily clad women that, you know, are simply appealing to our sensual desires. Understand that we are a nation in moral and spiritual decline. And recall that this has happened time and time again to other nations that turned against God. Well, again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our website, radioliberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, or I guess we'll be back here very shortly. May the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us our special guest this evening, Mr. John Rappaport. And we're hearing a lot of talk about the coming avian flu epidemic. Now, if you read the newspapers, and I read half a dozen newspapers every day, and we read a number of news magazines, and we watch television, although as little as we can, but we want to know what the enemy are doing, and you notice there's a tremendous emphasis on the danger of avian flu. The government is spending tens of, not hundreds of millions of dollars, in preparation for the avian flu epidemic that's going to sweep the world. And the working to get this vaccine available so that we can give it to the people to save their lives, because another global pandemic is probably coming, or possibly coming, or definitely possibly coming. Of course, we're told that over in the Asian area, why they've killed millions of birds, of chickens and ducks, to prevent this avian flu epidemic from spreading. Or other articles say they've spent hundreds of millions of they've killed hundreds of millions of fowl over there, the birds and ducks and chickens, to prevent the epidemic from spreading. And there have been over 50 people have died since 2003. That's over 2 years. And over 50 people have died from this disease that they fear is going to spread into the general population. And these articles, day after day, week after week, month after month, we're talking about the migratory birds who are going to spread the disease into Russia and into Europe. But, well, so far, there haven't been an awful lot of people who have gotten the disease. A few have, admittedly, and then there's this new virus that they've identified, the H5N1 virus. And this, of course, when you get the disease, it's extremely fatal. And they talk about King Hong or something like that, lake over in China, or district, where all of the birds, about 5,000 to 8,000 birds have died, and the Chinese won't let us come in and see really how many people have died. There's an awful lot of talk, an awful lot of emphasis on this, and as I see what's going on, I can't help but think of the swine flu epidemic back in 1966. They scared us to death about that, and it never materialized. And then we had the smallpox epidemic. Remember right after 9/11, we were so worried about a smallpox epidemic, and somehow the terrorists were going to get hold of smallpox and spread it throughout the world, and so we had to have plenty of the vaccine to give all the American people to protect us from smallpox, and everybody was going to have to get vaccinated, certainly all the first responders. But there wasn't any smallpox epidemic. Well, John Rappaport, you've written, and you seem to be very skeptical of this story. Let's get your thoughts.
Yes, good to be on with you, Stan. Well, I've been an investigative reporter for the last 20 years, and now have a website where I write daily news stories, and I've been covering this for quite some time. And like you, it reminds me very much of these prior doom and gloom scenarios that have been spread across the world. And I, early on, developed a great deal of skepticism about this, and am reading now that with all the warnings about hundreds of millions of people dying around the world because of this imminent flu epidemic, so far we have 112 cases in humans and 57 deaths. You know, and so what does that mean? Well, for any real scientist, what it means is that it would be preposterous on the basis of this to start predicting hundreds of millions of deaths. I mean, that's the first thing that you would see, and certainly the first thing that I saw. We also saw this with SARS, where there were dire predictions about how many people were going to die. And then the final count around the world was supposedly about 700 or 800. So my initial reaction to this was, you know, to be extremely skeptical. And I also noticed that the stories that were being printed in the press took the form of more propaganda than they did really information. It was all about warnings and possibilities, and we could see this, and it could happen as early as next year. This is the kind of thing that you see generated by PR agencies who have an agenda other than telling the truth.
Well, did you see these terms like, it's definitely possible that we will... Wait a minute, how could something be definitely possible we're going to have an epidemic? You know, so many of the adjectives are used so skillfully that you sort of end up getting confused.
Absolutely. And you also notice that the headlines of many of these stories are contradicted once you read down into the body of the text, when scientists admit that they really have no idea whether this is going to happen at all or if it's going to happen. But if you read the headlines and maybe the first paragraph, you get the feeling that probably in a couple of weeks we're going to see thousands of people dropping like flies all over the world. So this is yet another clue. And because I've written so many medical stories over the years, I have further reasons to be very, very skeptical. And one of those reasons is that very often when they call a case of a disease by a certain name and they say it's caused by a certain virus, and you call up the health agencies and you say to them, well, you reported on a man in Bangkok who got this particular disease. How exactly was the virus detected? Oh, well, we're not sure, and they did their tests, and they, you know, and you keep asking questions, and pretty soon you find out that nobody really has any clear idea of how the tests were run to determine that this person got sick from this particular germ as opposed to some other germ. Or was he already starving to death, or had he been regularly drinking contaminated water because he was living in a condition of utter poverty? And was the sewage being pumped directly into the drinking water, as is the case in certain third world countries? And you end up realizing that even with these minor number of cases, they're not ironclad at all. In fact,
now hold that thought right there, John. We're going to bring our stations right on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is John Rappaport. And John is taking a contrary opinion on the threat of the avian flu epidemic. And he's simply saying that when you really check out some of these stories, you know, when people are, it's said that so-and-so died from this disease, and then what he tries to actually pin the health authorities down as to how they made the diagnosis. Was this really a case of avian flu? Now, have you actually checked out some of these stories of the avian flu epidemic, or are you speaking more or less in generalities?
Well, I'm speaking in generalities. When it came to SARS, I did this investigation very carefully, and I found that, you know, there were many shocks along the way. I also did this with HIV and with West Nile virus, and the pattern is so similar. The claim is made that there are a certain number of human cases, and then when you try to pin down how they did the diagnosis and the testing, it's all very vague all of a sudden, and no one is willing to say what kind of test was used. No one seems to know. So this prompted immediate, you know, skepticism on my part, because it's well known to me that there are several different ways to make the diagnoses. And when they are made, they should be done in a very specific way, and often that is not the case.
Well, of course, when we're talking about the avian flu, why they're specifically looking for this one genetic pattern, the H5N1 virus, and certainly the World Health Organization has the ability to follow through and do the studies if they get the specimens. The question is, how many of the specimens have they actually checked, or how reliable are the laboratories that are doing that in China and, of course, in Southeast Asia? So I share your concern, and yet, of course, when you stop and think, 55, well, you say 57, what price number's going up, 57 people have died, and yet they're putting the whole world on alert about a pandemic. There's something wrong with this story. I mean, they're spending, it sounds like literally hundreds of millions of dollars on Tamiflu, which is a antibiotic specific for the avian flu, or at least it's specific for the flu. The recent studies, however, show you're going to have to take massive doses of that to get any real good out of it. And at $7 a tablet, why, if this is going to be prohibitively expensive. They're talking about Great Britain storing enough for a third of the people. What are they, a nation of, what, 50, 60 million people? That's an awful lot of money to be putting out massive doses of Tamiflu to in preparation for this coming pandemic, that there's no evidence the pandemic's going to occur.
Exactly. And then you begin to read about some of the adverse effects of these antiviral medications, and you realize that you're playing with fire, extremely dangerous materials that these drugs put into the body, especially at very high doses. And in the case of the flu, we're not really dealing with antibiotics at all because they're for bacteria, so we're dealing with kinds of medications that are much more toxic in terms of their effects on the body, and the general public really doesn't understand this, and they tend to take whatever medicines they're given. The vaccine as well, that's now under development, has been tested in a relatively small pilot program, and all kinds of positive affirmations are being spread around in the press about this vaccine and how the government is going to order huge numbers of doses, several million. But this vaccine is nowhere near the point where anybody would even call it safe. Vaccines in general, that's a whole other story about their toxicity and effects on the body, but even in this particular case, they are far from producing conventional type evidence that the vaccine is safe, and yet millions of doses are being collected.
Now, Chris, what really is interesting to me is that they've given, apparently, this vaccine to, 20 or 30 people, something like that. But they didn't have the disease. They didn't come in contact with the disease. And so we don't know whether it really protected them or not. All they said was we gave them the vaccine, and you know, they didn't get sick from the vaccine itself, which, of course, is very nice to know. But are you going to vaccinate the entire population based upon the supposition that since some people didn't get sick, that this is really going to help stop the spread of this epidemic? And then I always have that uneasy feeling because I know what they've done in the past in other countries where they put terrible things into the vaccines. Like in both Kenya and the Philippines, they put in a chorogonadotropin so women could not get get pregnant and they would have miscarriages. And we've this confirmed to me personally by doctors from both Kenya and the Philippines. And they sold it to the people in the name of why your children could get tetanus. It was given only to women of childbearing age. It was supposedly to prevent the mother and the child from getting tetanus of the umbilical cord and dying from that. And they gave all of these women immunizations, which had nothing to do with pretending them for tetanus, but for tetanus it had to do with preventing them from becoming pregnant. It was a massive experiment done without the knowledge of the people, and nobody was ever punished for that. And they would put things like that into the vaccines. What else would they put into the vaccines?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. That I'm very familiar with that massive experiment and all the denials that followed on it. We know that when you make vaccines, even in the normal way, if you're not trying to put anything sinister in it, like the hormone that was put into the tetanus vaccines, if you pass it, for example, through chicken eggs, you can pick up all kinds of germs, bacteria, and viruses and so forth that are in these eggs.
That are actually inherent in chickens.
Exactly. And I have spoken with people who've worked in vaccine manufacturing, and they admit to me readily that even though they try to purify the vaccines, there is no way of guaranteeing that chicken viruses and bacteria and so forth won't get into the vaccines. And then you inject this directly into the body, and you bypass a number of ordinary immune defense mechanisms, and you're putting these germs right into the body under the pretext of protecting people from diseases. So this is a very dangerous thing to do, but you can be sure that if this kind of propaganda continues about the avian flu, when they do release this vaccine for public use, there will be flocks of people, just like there were in the flu season, who will be running to their doctor to get it, thinking that it is some kind of protection, even though there is absolutely no proof that there is any protection from it.
Well, of course, we know, for instance, that the outbreaks now of measles or whooping cough in populations that largely have their vaccines. We know that if you were to take the influenza vaccine and you're between 60 and 65 and you take it three or four shots or for 3 or 4 years over a five-year period, according to Dr. Futenberg, who's one of the world's leading experts on the vaccinations, 10 years down the line, your incidence of Alzheimer's disease goes up 1,000% because there's mercury in the vaccine, there's aluminum in the vaccine, and both are toxic to the brain cells of both the young and the elderly. And the government knows that. They just don't want the people to know that. And we are told we have to get the routine influenza vaccines. But what bothers me is now they're trying to frighten us. We've got to take this new vaccine as soon as it's available, because there's definitely a possibility that we may get this. There may be a global pandemic. And yet I see absolutely no evidence of it, with 57 people dead. And we lose that many people from automobile accidents in the United States every single day. Why are they creating this hysteria?
Well, I think there are many reasons behind this, but I would mention one in particular, and that is, and you and I talked about this off the air, I have seen over the last, let's call it 15 to 20 years, a very stepped-up program by the World Health Organization and by various governments around the world to find a way to control people's actions that doesn't appear to be politically or ideologically motivated. And the medical route is a fantastic weapon to use if it is used in that manner. You can make people do all kinds of things and keep them from doing all kinds of things if you suddenly declare a medical emergency, if you order people to get certain medicines, if you say they are quarantined when there is no need for a quarantine, if you say that, for example, as there began to be hints of this during the SARS so-called crisis, that people who were criticizing the medical authorities or the government were now to be considered obstructionists and could be labeled as criminals for exercising their First Amendment rights in the situation, because the assumption was, well, this is all science, and you don't have the right to speak out when you endanger, quote, the public health.
Well, now, don't you think that there should be public health laws, and don't you think that if there really were a threat of a highly communicable disease, that people should be quarantined? Certainly, they've done this for years, and they were able to stop the spread of disease, and the SARS epidemic was really stopped, I think, because they used effective public health approaches to this epidemic, unlike many of the other epidemics they haven't tried to stop. But I think that most people would feel that there is a justification to isolate somebody who has the potential to infect large numbers of other people. Would you disagree with that?
Well, if we get into what happened with SARS and so forth, my investigation came to different conclusions.
All right. Well, we'll be glad to talk a little bit about that when we get back.
Okay.
But I think the significant thing is that the most powerful person in any community is the public health officer. He has more power, if he ever utilizes it, than the sheriff has. And I believe that there's a place for that if there's a real problem. Now, if there's not a real problem, then, of course, it's a very dangerous power to give to anybody. And so one of the potentials with the threat of the global pandemic would be the ability to isolate people, to quarantine people. If there's a problem, it's justified. If there's not a problem, then, of course, it's simply a misuse of power. And, of course, remember that absolute power corrupts absolutely. We'll be back in just a moment here with John Rappaport. Well, John, go ahead and pick up the story there. Of course, you were using then the analogy of the SARS epidemic, and you they were trying to create a hysteria here in America. Did we even have any cases in the United States? They had a few cases in Canada. Were there any cases here in the United States?
I think when all was said and done, there may have been about 30 or something like that, which, is a blip on the radar screen.
But I don't think we had any, we had hardly any deaths
here. No, I don't think we had any.
All right,
there were none that were confirmed whatsoever.
They had about, four or five in Canada? A few, anyway.
Yeah, possibly. The whole point about what happened in Canada was a lot of the investigation that I did centered around a microbiologist named Frank Plummer, who was the World Health Organization's man on the scene in Canada, and he was in charge of making all kinds of public statements about what the researchers was finding in the lab. And he inadvertently didn't really know what he was doing, said to the press on several occasions, and I have his quotes in my archives at No More Fake News. He said, you know, it's a strange thing. He said, at first we were finding perhaps 60%, 70% of the people that were being diagnosed as SARS actually had the virus. And then we found that it was 40% of the people that were being diagnosed. And then it kept on going down to 20 and 10%. And he said, now, of the people who are being diagnosed with SARS, we are finding the virus in 0%.
Well, now, was he saying that the original estimation was wrong, or was he saying that as the threat was there, why more and more people were thinking that they had SARS and they didn't? In other words, did he acknowledge that there were no cases initially, or that as time went by, there was less and less really to fear of it?
Well, what he was saying was that even initially, there were not, the percentages were not enough of people who actually had the virus to really say that this virus was the cause of SARS. And secondly, he was saying that over time, and he was not just talking about off-the-shelf diagnoses by doctors out in the boondocks. He was talking about people, you know, who were being diagnosed with SARS according to as many criteria as they could assemble that led them to believe that, yes, these people really did have SARS, and that they were finding eventually the virus in 0%.
Well, they did initially.
But then there was something else that I think is very important here that I want to stress, and that is, and people have to understand this, in order to say that a particular virus is causing a disease, you also have to give evidence that a person's body contains many, 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 many millions and millions and millions of these viruses of the same kind. And he acknowledged early on that even in the first cases, he said, he was puzzled by the fact that they found so few numbers of these SARS viruses in people. Well, that raised a tremendous red flag for a number of researchers I talked to, and they said, look, this is totally off the wall, because you just simply can't go out and say that you know that a certain virus is causing a certain disease if you can only find a few of these viruses in the body. That is completely counter to all conventional medical research. And that's exactly what Plummer was saying. And I queried health agencies in Canada. They refused to get back to me. They ran me around ragged trying to avoid the question. And
hold that thought there for just a minute, John.
Yeah.
We'll bring our other stations right on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We have John Rappaport on the line, and he says he actually talked to a number of the health agencies up there trying to pin them down as to how many people they were able to really isolate the SARS virus from. And, you know, and of course, he said that they really they gave him sort of the runaround, but even the major investigator up there said that if they did find the SARS virus, it really wasn't in very many people. And I had an uneasy feeling when this whole thing came out that we were not getting the full story. I didn't know what it was, and I still to this day don't know. But, I mean, suddenly this major epidemic strikes the world and then sort of peters out here in just a matter of a couple of months. One day where every newspaper is carrying articles about SARS and SARS and our attention is focused on it, just exactly as our attention is being focused on the danger of the avian flu epidemic today. And everybody was concerned. We saw the pictures of what was going on over in Hong Kong, when everybody walking around with their face masks on, and the streets and the shops were empty because of the fear of SARS. But you know, there's something wrong with the story. Were the people of Asia being manipulated? Were we being manipulated? Will you pick up the story there, John?
Yes, I began to look last April. I guess it's a year ago now, last April, into what was happening in Hong Kong with the SARS, so-called SARS epidemic. And fairly quickly, I came across several articles published in both Hong Kong and in the U.S. that readily stated that one quarter, 25% of all the SARS cases that were being diagnosed in Hong Kong were being found in the Amoy Gardens apartment complex. And that in this complex, what they had discovered was that there was a breakdown in the sanitation system. And that in the pipes, all kinds of human waste was being released from apartment to apartment. And the whole thing was literally and figuratively a complete mess. Well, because I've studied situations of disease in the third world, I knew immediately, you know, what they were dealing with, which is simply the fact that when the sanitation system breaks down in a country or in a building, it's the same effect. You have untold numbers of germs of all kind and all sorts of toxic material that is traveling through the pipes and that's being released into people's sinks and toilets and whatever, and people are getting sick. They're getting all kinds of sick. And regardless of what germs you isolate or find, you are never going to be able to remedy the problem until you fix the system. And that is why there are, one of the reasons why there are so many people who are dying day after day in these so-called third world countries. And that's exactly what was happening in Hong Kong. And when they eventually began to work on that plumbing system in that apartment complex, the cases diminished and the cases went away. In other words, people were no longer getting sick, which was more evidence that they were completely misrepresenting what was happening in Hong Kong. And they were trying to spread the story or the propaganda that the entire world was under, you know, some kind of attack from this germ. And again, the analogies are very clear to what we're looking at now with the so-called avian flu. The stories in the press keep proliferating day after day, week after week, month after month, which means that the health agencies, like the Centers for Disease Control, the World Health Organization, have their public relations people talking to reporters and putting out these ominous statements about what is maybe, could be, possibly, definitely, we don't know, going to happen. And therefore, everybody should be frightened and scared and should await orders as to what to do and should follow those orders when they come down. That is a very dangerous situation. That is the manufacture of a kind of fear behind no evidence. And it is ultimately motivated politically at the highest levels because it's an effort to control people when there is no evidence that you need to do anything about this.
All right. Well, I would certainly concede everything you are saying. If there really were an epidemic, though, if there really were a highly contagious epidemic such as we had in 1918, would you feel that under those circumstances, if it were a real epidemic, and we acknowledge that the information is correct, would you feel there would be a place for public health techniques and quarantine to stop the spread of a highly communicable disease?
Well, I would first have to be convinced that that's really what it was.
Well, no, that was my supposition. It really was true.
Yeah, that's
now.
The supposition. And so far, and, you know, we can talk about the 1918 flu, but so far, I have not come across any evidence that convinces me that we have experienced what we could call an incredibly communicable disease among
right
populations
there.
Where people have
hold
strong
that
immune systems.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is John Rappaport, and John is taking a contrary view as far as the danger of the avian flu epidemic. And really what's of interest to me is that the establishment, and I believe there is an establishment, that controls largely what the American people hear, what they read, what they see, and ultimately what they believe. And I believe that we saw this beautifully demonstrated in the July-August issue of Foreign Affairs magazine, where the three lead articles dealt with the coming epidemic. And it wasn't maybe an epidemic, it was the coming epidemic. Now, to have three articles all telling exactly the same story, and this is published in the single most prestigious magazine in the entire world, as far as I'm concerned. And there is no magazine that speaks of the views of the people who rule the world more than Foreign Affairs magazine. The second article was written by a man named Dr. Osterholm, who's one of the leading experts on this. In fact, he would be the, I remember, I think he works for the Office of Homeland Security. He would be responsible for handling a world plague. And he didn't say, you know, if it comes. He said the plague is coming. And he talked about all the horrible things that would result from that. And as I read his article, I mean, you couldn't help but have that feeling of stark fear. And then you sit back, as you have to, and say, why is he writing this? Why is the establishment focusing the attention of the American people on the threat of this epidemic? And so, with that as a background, why don't you pick the story up there, John?
If I'm not mistaken, and I'm sure you know the answer to this, is not Foreign Policy the journal published by the Council on Foreign Relations?
Yes, it's Foreign Affairs, and it is. Foreign Policy is actually published by the Carnegie Endowment, which is probably about the second most prestigious magazine, but Foreign Affairs is published by the Council on Foreign Relations, which is America's invisible government.
Exactly. So I think that you know, this is how we can begin to see the answer to this question as to, you know, where is the motivation coming from. There is a great deal of hay to be made, so to speak, in promoting a fake epidemic throughout the world and publishing articles like the ones that you're talking about, which no longer say if, but simply when, and it is coming. And those are the reason that articles like that are published is because think of the motives of this invisible government that is not just invisible.
Hold that thought right there, Ron. John, we're going to bring our... Okay, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is John Rappaport. And certainly we're talking about the avian flu epidemic. And, of course, the fact that recently in Foreign Affairs magazine, in the July-August issue of Foreign Affairs magazine, the three lead articles were all about the coming epidemic. It wasn't, is the epidemic going to come? Is there a possibility of a global pandemic that could kill literally tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people? Because pointing out that the influenza epidemic of 1918 and 1919 had killed 50 million. Of course, at the time they said 20 million, but suddenly the figure has swollen to 50 million. That's much more impressive. But the fact that Foreign Affairs, which is published by the Council on Foreign Relations, which is America's invisible government, would give three lead articles in the July-August issue of Foreign Affairs magazine to the threat of this avian flu epidemic. You have to ask why. And, of course, John, I'd asked him why he thought this was. Did you pick up the story there now, John?
Yes. I think we can see if... Let's look at it this way. Let's say that, and I think this is absolutely correct, the Council on Foreign Relations, which is linked to other such organizations and other nations, is an invisible government, not just in this country, but in many countries around the world. They are a global kind of octopus, and they control many, many agendas. They would see an epidemic like this, real or imaginary, in their terms, it really doesn't matter, as an opportunity to declare states of emergency, martial law, tremendous control over the citizens, and so forth. And these kinds of situations can be manipulated toward that end. Now, I have inferred from, and this is going back to 1987, when I began studying what I called disease hoaxes, and people can read about this at my website, nomorefakenews.com. You can structure a kind of epidemic which is not really an epidemic. In other words, suppose you begin injecting people with all kinds of toxic vaccines. That's a form of chemical warfare. It's particularly a form of chemical warfare if the people already have tremendously suppressed immune systems, as they do in the third world, and then you load them up with these vaccines that have all kinds of toxic ingredients in them, like formaldehyde and, as you were saying, aluminum and mercury and so on. Or you can put forward a secret scenario where you use some other kind of chemical warfare on selected areas of the planet. But to hide what you are doing, you call it a disease. And you bring in researchers who will find a germ. And you give drugs for it. And you give vaccines for it. And in the process, when you have people dying, in those areas you declare martial law for long periods of time. It puts populations completely under the control of troops in the streets and military, and there's all kinds of crackdowns and so forth on what people can do and can't do. Now you have a form of dictatorship under the rubric of, quote, dealing with an epidemic that really isn't a traditional epidemic at all. And this is what I believe some of these invisible government groups are really moving toward. This, I believe, is the kind of plan that they have on the boards. And this is why they continually harp on the coming epidemic of this and that without any evidence for it. You can't possibly say that hundreds or tens of millions of people are going to die if so far you have reported 55 or 57 deaths. That is completely preposterous, but yet they do it. They want to condition people to expect that this is going to happen. And if something like this does happen, I believe it will take place in the form that I've just described, which will be like a kind of secret war. And this is what these people believe is good for everybody else, because their thoughts are only about how to control huge masses of people and make them obey. That's what invisible government people are always shooting for.
Well, it's really very interesting. Most of our people have heard of the story of the War of the Worlds. A new movie is out, and one made actually 50 years ago on this subject. But in the interim, they put out a radio program. Orson Welles put that, and I've forgotten exactly when it was done. But they played this story of the War of the Worlds on major radio across America. And, of course, at the very beginning of the program, they said this was certainly just, this was not real. But people tuning into this program and hearing, and it was beautifully staged, hearing this idea that the aliens had landed and they were beginning to take over our major cities. And as this went on for really hours that people listened to this, people began to accept this as reality. And there were people actually calling in wanting to know what they could do to stop these alien invaders. And they really believed what they heard on radio. Well, later on, after this was all said and done, and Orson Welles had come on and apologized for any fear this might have created, it was found out that this is really a CIA operation. They wanted to see how they could mislead the people. And there were literally thousands of people in America who really believed, based upon that one radio program, that we were being invaded by Martians. And if they could do that with one radio program, think what they can do with articles in the paper, day after day after day, articles in the magazines, week after week, articles on television, or certainly programs on television talking about the danger of the global pandemic that's going to strike us at any time. So, I concur. I think that they are intentionally programming our minds, shaping our thoughts, and implanting certain ideas into our minds. And they, by so doing, they can control very effectively what we think and
Absolutely.
How we respond.
In that particular case of the Orson Welles broadcast, you had people running out into the streets, looking around, very fearful. Nothing like this had ever come on the radio before, and there was widespread panic, absolutely. And to add to what you said, traditionally, when these kinds of operations are done, there are follow-up reports. There are secret groups that talk about the success of this operation and how well it worked and how lessons could be applied in the future to other such propaganda efforts and mind control efforts and so forth, and how to use the media more effectively. And then something else happens, and those lessons are applied in a further kind of episode like that. And we are seeing that now. And unfortunately, it has come to the point where the symbol of the medical authority is so firmly implanted in people's minds all over the world that if quote an Orson Welles kind of broadcast, so to speak, although it would be carried on every channel, comes through the quote medical authority from the top, people will believe it. They will believe it more firmly than if it's a message that comes from the president or if it comes from the FBI or the police or whatever. This is where people have been so thoroughly conditioned year after year and day after day that this becomes a very viable strategy for staging whatever events people want to stage and provoking fear and panic and controlling people's minds. And I see this as the invisible government's mouthpiece for the future and for the future that they envision and they want everyone to have.
Well, that's why, of course, we have to teach people to be skeptical. We have to teach people to think. And when you see those articles saying there's definitely a possibility that this is going to happen, or there's definitely a probability that it may happen, a probability that it may happen, those two terms are, at variance with one another. Read carefully, question everything you read. And question certainly everything you hear on the radio and you read on the Internet, because there is so much disinformation up there. But the truth is out there. And, of course, we have to focus in on that and try to teach people how to think and think clearly. And when you see the entire media mobilized to sell us an idea, you know it just isn't true.
Yes. You know, you can also trace this back through some interesting movies like The Andromeda Strain and Outbreak and movies like this that prepare people to, again, believe in this kind of event as being, yeah, that sounds right, it sounds probable, it certainly could happen. And then you get all the actual, in heavy quotes, news stories coming down the pipeline. Some years ago, I read a very interesting article that had to do with the dreaded Ebola virus, which is one of those that, as soon as you mention it, you can see people kind of twitter and shiver and so forth because it's been presented in such a drastic and horrendous light. Well, there were several articles written during one of the Ebola outbreaks in Africa, and it quoted a couple of medical authorities in the Washington, D.C. area who said, of course, you know that if this germ happened to be present in Washington, D.C., in areas where people were well-fed, they had strong immune systems, they weren't under incredible amounts of the kind of stress that happens when you live below the poverty line, etc., etc., very few people would get sick at all. And this was buried about 12 paragraphs down in a story that was just filled with kind of panic-inducing propaganda. But the reporter never picked up on it. He didn't question the person further, the doctors further. He didn't find out really what was behind all that, which was, yet another example of the amazing kind of obliviousness of many reporters. But the real message on that is clear, and that is that if people are so distracted by these ominous kind of war of the world scenarios that are being piped into their brains every day in the media, they forget some of the basic facts, which is that if you are healthy, if you do whatever you can to be healthy in terms of your diet, in terms of your nutrition, in terms of the basic kinds of things that a person doesn't eat in order to remain strong, you are going to be free from a huge percentage of the possible kinds of diseases that other people do suffer from. And this is something that people really do need to focus on because it's a positive solution.
Well, I certainly think that certainly people need to know nutrition, the part that vitamin C and vitamin D and garlic and certainly selenium play in preventing this sort of disease, certainly the fish oils. All of these things are important in keeping your immunity up. And people certainly should be very seriously thinking about that. And I would simply put this out as a warning. I believe that it may well be that there will be an epidemic of some sort, whether it's the current epidemic or another epidemic. I mean, I believe this because I've read what the people on the other side talk about the necessity of eliminating a quarter of the world's population. Here I'm quoting Barbara Marx Hubbard in her book, The Book of Co-Creation. We have copies of the original original manuscript, and we'd be glad to send the important pages to you if you'd like to read them. And she talks about the necessity of killing a quarter of the world's population. And, of course, she was paraphrasing Revelation 6:8. And I look, and behold, a pale horse, and the rider upon him was death. And Hades followed shortly behind, and power was given to kill a quarter of the world with the sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with the beast of the world. And, of course, other translations are with pestilence, with disease. So I think we have to, of course, to do everything we can to know how to keep our immunity up. I think you're absolutely right, John. And I think people should do that all the time, and then, of course, have extra supplies on hand, because if there really were an epidemic, and I would not be surprised if somebody wouldn't engineer an epidemic, if there really were an epidemic, you're going to have to be able to look after yourself. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and I think that, you know, as I described earlier as we were talking, the kind of shape that such engineered epidemics could take, which, and now that you bring up Barbara Marx Hubbard, I think there's also a link to, and this is not a very good word, but I'll use it anyway, or a phrase, the environmental movement. It is certainly clear to me, because I've investigated many stories, that yes, there are definitely loose in the world certain corporations who have absolutely no conscience, and you find various communities and rivers and so forth that are extremely polluted with all kinds of chemicals, and horrendous things happen, and there are radioactive waste dumps where, you know, you wouldn't want to get within miles of these places, and so on and so forth, and I could run down the litany of that. But when you look at some of the controlling elements of the environmental movement at the highest levels of funding, curiously enough, you find these people who are bent on reducing the population of the planet in extraordinary ways that could only be signs that they are in favor of planned depopulation. And they couch this and hide it behind, quote, environmental concerns. And that is how they make it look like they are, you know, on Mother Nature's side and so forth and so on. But their agenda is quite, quite different.
And I agree with everything you're saying there. And I think that we have to be aware that this is a factor. And we don't know what's going to happen. All I know is that they're scaring us to death. And if there is a worldwide epidemic, it's going to have to be far different than what we have at the present time. In other words, it would have to be really altering the very structure of this H5N1 virus so that it would become very communicable from person to person. But that could be done because they have laboratories where they have the ability to create new diseases for means of mass killing. And anybody who questions that, we'll be glad to send them a copy of a page from the congressional testimony of Dr. MacArthur, who testified in July 1st of 1969 that they wanted $10 million to create a new disease that would not be responsive to the immune system, a new method of mass killing, and we want the money to produce it. If you want to see the testimony, we have it. In 1969, they had the ability to create new diseases. Think what we've been able to accomplish here in the last 36 years. We'll be back here in just a moment to with John Rappaport to begin to wrap up this evening's fascinating program. John, do you want to get your telephone number out, your website?
Website would be very nice, yes.
What is, go ahead.
That is www.nomorefakenews.com.
Go hold that thought. Hold it. Well, this is, John, let's get that website out one more time.
Yes. It's www.nomorefakenews, all one word, .com. And you will see that I'm going to be doing a telephone workshop coming up in a very short amount of time here. That part of the title of that is Disease Hoaxes. And so I will be expanding on a number of things that we've been discussing tonight and lead into the subject of healing that really does make a person strong and maintain their immune systems. And so people who visit my site will be able to see that, and if they want to, they can sign up for that. You know, in talking about the idea of planned epidemics, I again have to go back and refer to the idea of using a germ as a cover story in which the real culprit is a chemical that is used, because this makes a very ironclad kind of story. Obviously, you don't want to blow the whistle, or the invisible government, so to speak, doesn't want to blow the whistle on the fact that widespread dying of people is being caused by intentionally by a chemical. But the thing about a chemical is that you can control it to a very specific extent, where you put it, how long it lasts, how long it's toxic, and so forth. In the case of a germ, there are a number of unpredictabilities that occur, and it is less likely to be the kind of thing where you can say, well, this many people will be affected and others will remain, you know, unaffected and so forth. And so look for this kind of scenario where people are talking about a germ, but you don't see any evidence that they really know that it really is lethal. The case numbers that are being reported of people who are getting sick are very small, and yet the predictions are incredibly ominous. And then think about the possibility of that being used as a kind of cover story to conceal the fact that what will happen is that it will be a chemical that is really being used.
And of course, it's sort of like a shell game is what you're really describing. And of course, you know, you just can't see where the pee is because they keep moving their hands so quickly. John, it's been a fascinating time. Thank you so very much for being with us. And I hope we can get you on again.
Thank you very much, Doctor. I appreciate it.
Good night. And our guest this evening has been John Rappaport. And of course, I think that it's got a fascinating input. And well, we're just going to have to wait and see. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and John and I were just discussing what he thinks and he sees coming down. And he sees that they are going to try to scare us to death with some sort of a story and focus our attention on the threat of an infection, whereas they may very well produce a chemical or utilize a chemical to begin to depopulate and kill the earth and kill off large numbers of people. You can control a chemical far better than you can control a disease that you release on the general population. This was his thought. Of course, I didn't get a chance to comment that now they have the ability to create race-specific diseases. Why is AIDS so widespread in Africa and not widespread in the United States? Well, very, very simply, because the disease has predilection for blacks. They have certain genes that white people don't. And this epidemic, this disease, is race-specific. And they actually have that ability. They want to. If you haven't yet read the Project for the New American Century website and pull down their little pamphlet called Rebuilding America's Defenses. Now remember, Project for the New American Century is the government of the United States today. The original 25 members, there would be people like John Bolton, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Scooter Liddy, certainly we could go down the line of some Sidney Paul Wolfowitz, Gary Bauer, William Bennett, the people who really are controlling our government from behind the scenes today, or acting as publicists to convince either the Protestant or the Catholic populations to go along with the agenda of the people who really run the government. But on their website, newamericancentury.org, pull down their booklet entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses, and then I think it's about page 62, somewhere in there. They talk about this idea that now we're going to be able to create new race-specific diseases. So this is puts a whole new slant on genetic engineering, because you can produce diseases that will hit specific races. If you want more information on that, that's covered in my syllabus, entitled Iraq, the Untold Story. That's Iraq, the Untold Story. You need to have the information. You need to understand what's going on today. You need to understand there is a population control agenda. And if you haven't read my monograph on the population control agenda, you can pull it down at our website, www.radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. I am going to be going east to make a video. We'll be traveling this coming weekend, and we are going to have a talk on planned population reduction. That's planned population reduction. People have to understand that the people on the other side know exactly what they're doing. The last thing they want is for the American people to understand what's happened. There are 2 billion people in the world today. 2 billion people have been infected with hepatitis B, and about 15% of them are chronic carriers of hepatitis B. Almost every child in underdeveloped countries, according to the World Health Organization, is infected or has been infected with hepatitis B. How did they get it? Well, according to the World Health Organization, you get it from mother to child at birth. You get it from child to child, or you get it from sexual activity, but children, of course, are not engaged in sexual activity, or you get it from contaminated transfusions or needles. Well, I don't think children infect other children. Only 15% of the mothers are infected. I don't think most children are taking contaminated transfusions, but almost every child is getting vaccinated with dirty needles. And 2 billion people in the world have been infected with hepatitis B. Those figures come from the World Health Organization website. Get the information. Find out if what we're saying is true. Our website, www.radioliberty.com. Our telephone number, if you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters on population control, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.